Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Tenacious Beasts, Wildlife Recoveries That Change How We Think About Animals, by Christopher J. Preston. Read by Tristan Morris. Resurgence. Standing on the dock in the dead of Arctic winter, Svein Anders closed his eyes to the northern lights above. All the professor wanted to do right now was listen. As the mountains and green aurora faded from his retina, the sound of a gently rippling ocean washed over his body. Seconds after his mind quieted, he heard a splash of a large object, followed by a fierce exhalation of air. Then he heard another, then another. A fishy scent wafted shoreward. Casting his head back to the sky, Svein Anders' mouth cracked open as he drank in the frigid nighttime air. He was perched on the doorstep of whales. Dozens and dozens of whales, humpback and killer whales, drawn to Norway's Kaldfjord in the winter months to feast on herring. The professor lived on the fjord for its cold beauty. Mountains rose in a wall before his kitchen window. Birch trees formed a stubble around his house. Lingonberry flowers speckled the hills in June. The professor built his home with reused materials, spending hours straightening old nails in order not to buy new. He kept chickens and grew potatoes, raised and slaughtered his own sheep. For income, he taught environmental classes at a nearby university and published opinion pieces in the local paper on wind farms, reindeer herding, and the politics of nearby fisheries. His life ebbed and flowed with the seasons. But the experience on the fjord that night was new. Whales were back in their hundreds, and his neighbor's world was being transformed. The professor felt only elation, but the professor was not the only person having a new experience with wildlife that year. It was well past midnight when Sue Davies woke to the sound of a sharp hiss beside her bed in an English seaside town. She bolted upright and fumbled for the light switch. An animal ran quickly out of the bedroom door. Squinting in the brightness, Davies saw the bed covers pulled to one side and felt a pain in her leg. She looked down and saw a small patch of skin starting to swell. She put on bedroom slippers and hobbled downstairs. Her shoes were spread across the kitchen floor, and the cat flap lay shattered in the mudroom. Davies had been bitten by a fox. The first thing Davies thought was rabies. Bats, feral cats, and foxes all carry the deadly disease. She drove hurriedly to Eastbourne General District Hospital to get the bite mark examined, worrying the emergency room staff would think she was mad. A fox in an upstairs bedroom at 2 a.m. sounds absurd. The doctor inspected her leg and carefully cleaned the wound before sending her home with a tetanus shot. As far as rabies was concerned, Davies needn't have worried. The English Channel keeps infected animals out of the United Kingdom. Davies went home healthy, but alarmed. A wild animal wandering through a modern, centrally heated house is a form of heresy. It challenges the barrier between the safe space of home and the wild world beyond. In the UK, where the landscape is gentle and most of the large animals you see are domesticated, a threat to this barrier is almost a full-scale cultural assault. Davy's experience turns out to be far from unique. A fox bit twin girls Lola and Isabella Couperus in their upstairs bedroom in Hackney, central London. Another entered a home in southeast London and grabbed a 4-week-old baby off his bed, nearly severing his finger. A third pushed through a kitchen door in Plymouth and bit a 7-month-old sitting in her bouncer in the kitchen. Nobody knows for sure why foxes are entering so many homes, but one thing nobody disagrees about is this. In the last couple of decades, people are encountering many more foxes in their daily lives. Their pointed faces are everywhere, poking their noses into rubbish bins, darting through hedgerows, and walking jauntily along the tops of garden walls. Emboldened foxes and fjords full of whales tell us something. Amid a crushing wave of bad news, a handful of wildlife species have bounced back. The recoveries create glimmers of hope and bring complicated challenges. What they show about animals and their tenacity is inspiring. What they demand from minds unaccustomed to their presence is where some of the deepest puzzles lie. We need, in short, a new way to think about animals. The news about animals is bleak. Wildlife populations have declined 20% over the last century. More than 900 species have been wiped off the face of the Earth since industrialization. At least 1 million are threatened with extinction, many of which now number less than 1,000. Vertebrates are particularly hard hit, with populations plummeting over 60% since 1970. Birds in North America are down 29%. More than 40% of amphibians and 1/3 of ocean corals are in danger. The collapse is almost certain to get worse. Nearly 3/4 of ice-free land and 2/3 of the oceans have been transformed by human activities. 70% of the world's fresh water is devoted to crop and livestock production. Soil is eroding 100 times faster than it is being built. The signs of human dominance are everywhere. 96% of the weight of the world's mammalian life is either human or domestic animals. Let that sink in. People and their livestock weigh 24 times all the elephants, whales, and tigers combined. Climate change is adding to the problems. Temperatures on land have risen 1.59 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, climbing more at high latitudes. 50% of Australia's Great Barrier Reef dies back each summer due to coral bleaching, a number that's only going to increase. Barely 7% of ocean fish stocks are harvested at sustainable rates, and marine waters are becoming warmer and more acidic. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change predicts that only a few years are left before many low-lying island nations, together with the biodiversity they support, will sink beneath the waves. And yet, despite the grim outlook for wildlife and despite the relentless stream of bad news, some animal populations are on the rebound. Humpback whales in the western Indian Ocean have surged from 600 in the middle of the last century to over 30,000 today. Black bears in California have quadrupled in a few decades. Storks are breeding in southern England for the first time since the Middle Ages. Wolves now number more than 12,000 in Europe, and their range has expanded into densely populated countries, including the Netherlands and Belgium, where they have been absent for a century. None of this should be happening. With such a dire outlook for wildlife, how is any of this possible? The chapters ahead probe the mystery by looking at a number of wildlife recoveries. Each section tracks one or more animals and reveals how their numbers have bucked the larger trend. It asks how things can go so right when so much is going so wrong. The focus is mainly on species in the United States and Europe, because these are places I know best. One is the continent on which I grew up. The other is the continent on which I am growing old. I don't claim anything I say about animal recoveries is unique to these locations. I'm confident the lessons are available elsewhere. There are probably clearer or more illuminating cases to explore, but I focus on where I have lived and worked, for these are the places most familiar to me and where my affections are most fierce. The recoveries are not hard to spot. Roe deer rutting in the forest where I grew up in southern England. Pronghorn antelope trotting west of the Continental Divide near my home in Montana. Sea-bound trout flicking their tails past dismantled dams in Washington State. Bears crunching acorns in Italy's Apennines. When you scratch the surface and turn a few stones, you find animals everywhere, waiting for a chance to return. Highlighting the recoveries is not to question the established wisdom about species loss. The truth cannot be doubted. For every success, there are 10 cases of continuing decline. Enormous challenges lie ahead in the form of climate warming, increasing consumption, the spread of non-native species, and habitat loss. Some of the recoveries I discuss are tentative. A few may never get off the ground at all. So let me be absolutely clear from the start, because I want no possibility of misunderstanding. This book is not designed to provide soothing reassurances about wildlife. Animal populations are not out of danger. Their outlook remains dire, but there are reasons to examine the fragments of good news. The first is to provide hope. Amid growing mountains of loss, some species have shown the tenacity to bounce back. Their recoveries can inspire us. If we create the right conditions, if we offer them a slender chance, we may be surprised by the rapid resurgence of animal life. This is what wildlife does. It seizes its opportunities. Creative and adaptive creatures stand waiting in the wings, hardwired to seize their moment. Alongside hope, there's another reason to write this story, more philosophical than ecological. The return of animals demands something from us. Wildlife challenge entrenched ways of thinking and shake us from well-worn habits of mind. They teach us better ways of being in the world. This is no longer the 19th century, when industrializing nations felt entitled to exploit wildlife as they saw fit. Humans possess a range of new tools and an assortment of new desires. If wild animals are to flourish on 21st century landscapes, a different set of attitudes must take hold. We need a better way to think about wildlife. The chapters ahead contain plenty of ecological details, but they also hint at a philosophy, a roadmap to a future state of mind. Each section of the book highlights one essential change in attitude that recovering species demand. Often, this means a change in how to act, but it can also mean a change in how you think. You should listen to this book looking for the transformation in attitude recommended in each section. Farmland Villains probes how recovering wolves in Europe challenge the gulf between the wild and the civilized. Prairie Puritans uses the return of bison to ask whether some returning wildlife are more authentic than others, and whether this has anything to do with genes. River Engineers discusses salmon, dams, and beavers to pose questions about human expertise with managing complex systems. Forest Managers considers when owls, bears, and wildcats should and should not be left alone. Ocean Partners looks at humpback whales and sea otters and asks if they can be thought of as allies in a generational battle. On each landscape, I make the case for a better set of ideas around wildlife. I tease out more suitable ways of thinking about the species that surround us. Some cultures failed spectacularly to live alongside animals first time around. They wiped them out thoughtlessly and without compassion. I use a handful of wildlife recoveries to ask how things might be different this time, how we might consider animals in ways that let them live. Embracing these fresh states of mind won't be easy. Changing how we think is often harder than changing what we do. But the cost of doing nothing will be the end for many species, and we will encounter some excellent guides along the way. On a rural road in Canada a few Octobers ago, I pulled the car over to stare at two long-legged animals loping confidently through an adjacent field. They trotted nonchalantly along, not far from several dozen unconcerned cows. I'd never seen a wolf outside a national park before, but I knew instantly what they were. When I lowered my window, the pair of wolves stopped and stared directly at my vehicle. There was an assertiveness in their look. They belonged on the land. As I admired the luster of their coats and the muscled curve of their haunches, I felt my place in the world shift just a notch. The feeling was uplifting, but at the same time, mildly disorienting. I had not expected them there. Something in my mind had to shift. The wolves finally grew tired of looking, bumped shoulders, and resumed their lope across the field. I drove the car back onto the road, with electricity coursing through my blood. The feeling did not fade for many miles. It persists in the chapters of this book. Farmland Villains. 1. Cars and Carcasses. Hugh Jansman's work puts him in closer contact with wild predatory carnivores than any Dutchman in 140 years. Closer, at least, to the dead ones. Jansman is a wildlife ecologist at Wageningen University, part of a team responsible for investigating suspicious deaths of animals in the woods, heaths, and farmlands of the Netherlands. There has recently been an uptick in demand for his skills. The squat, curly-haired Jansman is trained in medicine and anatomy. He is an expert at cutting up dead bodies. He pairs his knowledge of animal physiology with the latest tools in DNA analysis to unearth the truth behind an animal's last moments. It sounds like a gory job, spent in close proximity to blood, saliva, and stomach contents. Most of the time, it probably is. But the 42-year-old ecologist grins like a 5-year-old when you ask him to talk about the new animal that is increasingly on the sharp end of his dissection knife. Jansman lives in the Veluwe, a large wooded area in the center of the Netherlands. At just over 1,000 square kilometers, the mixed landscape feels as much like wilderness as anything found in Holland. The hills and ridges of the Veluwe rest high and dry, pushed upward by advancing Pleistocene glaciers. Like most landscapes in the Netherlands, this does not make them very high or particularly dry. Their mightiest folds reach only 350 feet above the gray waters of the North Sea. The forests are greened by more than 30 inches of rain per year. Even though they lack the soaring beauty of the Dolomites or the Pyrenees, Jansman loves it here. He loves it even more now that this wild heart of the Netherlands has gained a remarkable new resident. In the summer of 2019, two wolves paired up in the Veluwe and gave birth to a litter of pups. The Netherlands had its first resident wolf pack in a century and a half. Among well-ordered tulip fields, picturesque windmills, and grass-covered dikes, the arrival of a wolf pack was rattling. Wolves padding through the Veluwe didn't just signal a notable ecological change. It prompted an urgent confrontation about what it means to be Dutch. Wolves vanished from the Netherlands in the mid-19th century. The truth is, they never stood a chance. Farmers saw them as a threat to their livestock. Hunters blamed them for declines in deer. They were massacred by the hundreds with traps, poison, and guns. The surviving wolves struggled to find prey as the human population grew and forests made way for agriculture. A carefully crafted anti-wolf mythology stoked the desire for their slaughter. Wolves were evil, sharp-fanged beasts that preyed on children. They were, according to one early commentator, the very incarnation of destruction, with his powerful jaws of shark teeth and the cunning of man. Villagers feared and then demonized them. Famines were known simply as the wolf. A painful and disfiguring skin condition was called lupus vulgaris. The creature's presence was deemed incompatible with civilized life. Hunters, farmers, and those who held a vendetta went to war on the retreating packs. By 1869, the last Dutch wolf was dead. Europeans celebrated their demise. The slaughter fit the worldview they occupied. The rationalist philosophy of René Descartes created a perfect space for wolf hatred. Descartes, who published most of his major works while living in the Netherlands, insisted there was a giant metaphysical gulf between humanity and the rest of creation. Humans alone had a mental element to their existence. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. Animals were simply machines stitched together out of flesh and sinew. They had no mind, no experience, no feelings. Descartes thought nothing of experimenting on dogs and cats without anesthesia. A wriggle or a yelp was like a squeaky brake on a car. Everything could be explained mechanically. There was no pain in the animal kingdom. Its residents had no value other than the ways they satisfied human whim. The chasm Descartes proposed between humans and animals fit neatly alongside the prevailing Christian worldview. Humans sat on a divinely sanctioned pedestal. The rest of creation was there to serve them. The metaphysical gulf suited the scientists and industrialists of the emerging Dutch Empire. The natural world was there for the taking, whatever the cost in animal and often human blood. Wildlife were persecuted without guilt until well after most of them were gone. For more than a century and a half, nobody seemed to care about the wolf's absence. Farmers told enough fables about the big bad wolf that it seemed like a good riddance. Fairy tales collected by the Brothers Grimm were populated with wolves who tricked and hurt humans. Stories like Little Red Riding Hood ensured European children grew up with an exaggerated fear of the wolf. The animal itself now existed in memory only. After a couple of generations, the thought of a wolf lurking in the shadows slipped away. Wolves were a haunt from a previous era, a time when windmills were the main source of power, and a formidable Dutch navy protected trade routes all the way to Southeast Asia. All this sat comfortably with the Dutch, until after more than a century's absence, a wolf carcass showed up unexpectedly on a busy roadside. An early morning driver found the body of a 110-pound female on the edge of a field near Luttelgeest in Flevoland. The dead wolf appeared to have been hit by a car. Its bone structure was damaged, and flecks of blood on its fur pointed to a high-speed impact of some sort. The public was flabbergasted. Some thought it was a hoax, similar to the case of a dead seal that had shown up in a field 60 miles from the sea a few years previously. It was hard to imagine a wolf running through the middle of one of the most intensely managed landscapes on Earth. Wildlife biologists were elated, but a little suspicious. They knew wolf numbers had been climbing across the border in Germany. They understood the Dutch habitat wasn't much different from the habitat to the east. Reports from German farmers and grainy nighttime footage from camera traps confirmed wolves were heading in their direction. Wolf supporters had been holding their breaths for Europe's most storied canid to lope across the border into the Netherlands. They had already founded an organization, Wolven in Nederlands, to look after them when they arrived. Officials in the city of Steenwijk collected the body and put it in a cooler while they pondered what to do. Jansman chuckles from behind his lion's mane of hair when he recalls how there were doubts about the Ludelgeest wolf from the start. It all seemed a bit too sudden. The place where the carcass showed up was a bit odd for the first Dutch wolf in 150 years. It was close to a densely populated district and over 60 miles from the German border. Until then, nobody had reliably confirmed a wolf on the Dutch side of the line. There had been rumors. An engineer on a train from Amsterdam to Almere glimpsed a wolf-like animal trotting away from the tracks. A farmer swore he had seen a wolf crossing his fields, and a walker spotted muddy prints and suspicious-looking scat. But there was no solid evidence. If this new wolf had made it all the way to Flevoland before getting hit, she'd managed to keep a remarkably low profile on the way. The day after the carcass was found, the wolf became Jansman's responsibility. His lab at Wageningen University was instructed to conduct a necropsy with assistance from the Dutch Wildlife Health Center in Utrecht. He drove over to the city of Steenwijk and picked up the carcass. He remembers the surreal feeling of driving the Netherlands' first wolf in over a century across town in the back of his car. He wanted to yell out the window about what he had in the trunk. Back at the lab, Jansman and his colleagues quickly confirmed it was a wolf and sent out some DNA for analysis. The X-ray machine needed for a full necropsy was broken, but people wanted answers fast. When Jansman's team started cutting into the wolf, right away, they encountered puzzles. The stomach contents showed the last thing the wolf ate was a beaver. When the beaver's partially digested tail was tested, carbon isotopes matched isotopes from Eastern Europe and the Baltics, over 700 miles away. This was a long way for a wolf to travel between meals. Jansman and his colleagues expected their investigation to reveal injuries from a car's impact, but when the forensic team looked closely, they discovered damage to the skeleton consistent with a high-velocity projectile. When they finally got hold of an X-ray machine, it revealed metal fragments and signs of a bullet grazing the wolf's spine. They also found matching holes in its skin. The wolf hadn't been killed by a car at all. Someone had shot it, probably in Poland, before driving it across two countries and placing it alongside a Dutch road as some sort of joke. Those who earlier appeared on TV celebrating the return of the wolf suddenly found themselves looking foolish. Jansman says all the hype had been distracting. A little more patience would have spared some blushes, but the false start served an important purpose. The hoax woke up the Dutch to the fact Canis lupus was about to reclaim its place in their country. Young wolves are constantly on the lookout for new territory, and habitat in Germany was filling up fast. Only 3 months before the carcass appeared in the Ludelgeest, a German wildlife camera snapped pictures of a wolf less than 10 kilometers from the border, a casual morning stroll for a wolf. Jansman knew it was only a matter of time before a wolf ignored the lines drawn by Europeans on their maps and reclaimed another part of its range. The Dutch government quickly issued a statement, making it clear all arriving wolves would be protected. The European Union's 1992 Habitats Directive safeguarded wolves across their entire natural habitat. This meant EU member states must provide protection anywhere the wolf used to howl. Not only were wolves coming back to the Netherlands, when they did, they would be here to stay. Right on cue, credible sightings of wolves started to trickle in. 3 different eyewitnesses spotted a wolf walking close to the Dutch town of Twente before it apparently returned to Germany. The following year, several people filmed the wolf trotting down the pavement of a housing estate near Groningen. Others recorded footage of the same wolf walking near wind turbines on an industrial estate. The wolf seemed unusually comfortable around people, prompting a headline in the British Daily Mirror. Terrifying footage of wolf prowling city streets looking for its next meal. Jansmann, who was carefully monitoring the wolf sightings and matching the photographs with a German database, doubted the Mirror's take. He had his own theory about the unusual behavior. The wolf was likely habituated to humans by German soldiers feeding it on military bases over the border. Despite the Daily Mirror's alarm, many Dutch people found images of a wolf walking down a street in broad daylight more perplexing than terrifying. The Netherlands doesn't look like a place that can support a wolf pack. The landscape is highly domesticated. Tractors plow straight lines across fields ringed by well-maintained drainage ditches. Flocks of free-range chickens spill out of sheds into neatly fenced rectangular plots. Large blue locomotives marked by the NS of the National Railway Carrier crisscross the countryside on electrified tracks. Bicyclists dart around like honeybees on a trail system that is a source of national pride. Having one of the most iconic symbols of the wild trotting through the middle of all this was bizarre. If many Dutch people were happy, Jansmann was ecstatic. As an ecologist and wildlife enthusiast, he knew the benefits. Dutch hunters and government agencies have to kill nearly 90% of the wild boar and 2/3 of the deer in the Veluwe each year to prevent crop damage. The wolves were going to help out wildlife managers. They would kill some deer and teach the rest to be more skittish. Wolves were also going to make the landscape more interesting to people like Jansmann. Many Europeans craved the experience of wildlife available in North America, Africa, or Southeast Asia. It was hard to find anything like it at home. There was a reason Jansmann chose to live in the Veluwe. Increasing the diversity of local wildlife would add spice to Dutch life. But Jansmann's excitement was also tempered with a strong dose of realism. He knew wolves would complicate things. Learning to live with wolves was returning to a perilous past. Centuries of prejudice stacked the deck against the wolf's return. For most people, wolves still existed on a different plane of being. They were powerful predators with sharp teeth and claws. They slunk around under cover of darkness, stealing what they needed. They killed the animals humans raised for themselves, leaving the carnage undiscovered until dawn. The challenge presented by the wolf in the Netherlands is a potent illustration of what many animal recoveries demand. To recover a wild animal, you don't just need the right habitat, enough shelter, and sufficient prey. Nor is recovery simply a matter of better practices to allow humans and wildlife to coexist. You need to do more. You need to think differently about what the word wildlife really means. A non-expert might wonder, initially, how wolves have recovered so well. Females are sexually receptive for only 1 or 2 weeks each year. A typical litter ranges between 4 and 7 pups, but only half make it into adulthood. The mother's life is devoted almost entirely to the survival of her offspring, who have a lot to learn before they can thrive. For someone who doesn't know wolves, the odds look long, but Canis lupus has a trick or two up its sleeve. Wolves are smart and adaptable. They are generalist feeders. Their brains are packed into the body of one of nature's supreme athletes. A complex social structure makes the pack into a well-tuned survival machine, year in and year out. Wolves, it turns out, are capable of astonishing comebacks. Wolves mate in winter or early spring. The pack's breeding pair digs out a den from a hillside or under a tree root. The mother stays active in pack life until she feels the arrival of her young is imminent, at which point she retreats to the den. After 62 days of gestation, the pups are born blind and deaf. They nurse every few hours for several weeks. The mother remains in a den with the young and relies on the other adults to bring her food. The hungry pups grow fast, gaining about 3 pounds a week. The pups' eyes open after 2 weeks, always blue at first. At 3 weeks, Their flopped over ears perk up.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?